Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this next half hour, once again, we're going to be visiting with Ray Coleman, the attorney for Bill Tyree and a law partner of William Pepper, author of Orders to Kill, attorney for the late James Earl Ray. We're visiting with Mike Rupert, former LAPD narcotics detective and a crusader against the intelligence community's involvement in the drug traffic, and also Dee Carone Ferdinand, the daughter of Albert Vincent Carone, one of the more important and very enigmatic figures in the American national security establishment over the last 50 years or so. Gentlemen and lady, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you very much.
Okay. In our last, in the discussion that we were having before we concluded our last half hour, we were talking about some of the many organized crime figures that were known to you, Dee, as associates of your father.
Mm-hmm.
And among those organized crime figures that were known to your father was a fellow named William Casey.
Well, okay, if you want to put him in organized crime.
I think that would be a very fair characterization. There was obviously an element of humor in that, but I think that he belongs in that context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll say that.
Okay.
I'll agree with you.
All righty.
A lot of inside trading went on between the families, and William Casey had a big part in it. William Casey would give information to my dad. In return, my dad would give it to Paul Castellano. And people made a great deal of money off of the inside training.
Inside trading?
Uh-huh.
Now, is this in the stock market?
Yes.
Now, of course, William Casey was actually director of the Securities and Exchange Commission under Richard Nixon.
Well, wasn't that convenient?
It certainly would be a very good insider if you're going to be doing some trading.
Yes.
Now, of course, William Casey had been in the OSS, later became director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and in that context also would have been dealing with your father.
Definitely. They were friends and business associates.
And your father's activities on behalf of CIA continued up until the point where his health began to fail, and we'll talk about that later. What are you in a position to tell us about something that was codenamed Amadeus, then, that your father dealt with, Dee?
I cannot actually, from what I understand of Amadeus, it goes back to World War II. It was the umbrella for many operations that had started. World War II, getting gold out, getting people from Germany, SS officers, etc., into the South American countries to set up different routes. Okay? They also moved gold out through the Vatican.
And these activities were subsumed under the name Amadeus?
Yes.
Okay.
And Jared was perfect for it because, number one, he was Italian. Number two, he went to Italy often. And number three, he had the connections to the organized crime figures.
With regard to Amadeus, these activities subsumed under that code name were obviously going on for quite some time after the conclusion of World War II. For how long a period of time, or up and what is the most recent recollection you have of Amadeus time-wise?
Well, 1984, 1985.
So the activity.
My father would get phone calls,
mm-hmm.
and all of they would say is that they needed to speak to Al. Okay, if you asked who it was, you were told, tell him Amadeus. There were many times, though, that when my father made a phone call, it would be Amadeus. Now, at these times, when these phone calls came in, my father would actually leave the house within a 20-minute to half-hour period. And this is here in New Mexico.
Okay.
Okay. What they were doing, the only thing I can tell you is Dad had very heavy involvement with drug running. Very heavy involvement with drug running. Into South America, Latin America, Mexico. Around 1984, 85, Dad went to a place called Chapatula. I'm probably saying it wrong. And there was a mission down there, or an operation, in which the entire village was wiped out. There was a mass grave that every woman, child, and man was put into.
Do you know what country this was in?
Mexico.
In Mexico?
Yes.
Okay.
It was around the same time of Kiki Camarena's death. My father was a good friend of Kiki Camarena's, so to speak. Kiki, allegedly, I will say that, rode both sides of the fence also.
Mike Rupert, fill us in briefly who Enrique Kiki Camarena was.
Enrique Kiki Camarena was a senior DEA field agent in Mexico who was working in 1985, believe it was, on a series of investigations which centered around the drug rings of Rafael Caro Quintero and Miguel Angel Felix Gallardo in the Guadalajara cartels. At the same time, and it has been documented by Peter Dale Scott and the Kerry Committee report, that Angel Gallardo and Quintero were running Contra training camps in the Veracruz area of Mexico. So we have a strong connection between this particular drug ring, which was moving 4 tons of cocaine a month, and the Central Intelligence Agency, and it was also this particular drug ring that Kiki was investigating, also in connection with large fields of marijuana, and I mean, we're talking thousands of acres, when he was kidnapped along with his pilot, transported to another house in Mexico, over a period of days tortured and summarily executed. And he was the only DEA agent ever to have been killed in the line of duty in Mexico, and I think possibly in all of Latin America.
Okay. So that's who Enrique Kiki Camarena was, and we're going to talk about your father's relationship to him more in just a second, Dee, but by way of reviewing some of what you've covered so far, Amadeus was a code name for a variety of activities, Dee, going back to the Second World War involving gold being smuggled out of Europe through the Vatican, SS officers being relocated in Latin America, and some of the drug smuggling that your father was involved in also was subsumed under Amadeus. Am I getting this right?
Yes, you are.
Okay. And these activities, codenamed Amadeus, this group of activities was still underway as of the mid-1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when that's when Kiki Camarena died. Can you tell us something about your father and the activities and death of Kiki Camarena? You mentioned before Mike filled us in on his background that he was allegedly working both sides of the street.
I could only tell you that my father was the paymaster and one of the key figures involved in Kiki's death. It seems that Kiki, let's say, got greedy and wanted more cuts. As far as money goes. And people also have to understand that when I state money or payment, it wasn't so much always money as a certain part of the cut of cocaine for them to do it as they chose, whether they chose to sell it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Kiki, it seems, was getting a little bit greedy in what he wanted, and also threatening to disclose certain things. Therefore, Kiki had to be eliminated. And he was.
Mm-hmm. And his death generated quite a bit of publicity in the United States, although certainly many of the activities he was involved in did not receive that kind of attention. Ray Coleman, you mentioned in the interview that we had earlier this week that from a legal standpoint, Albert Caron, it could be said to be the glue that ties together many of the disparate elements of this investigation. I wonder if you'd flesh that out for us before we get back to Dee.
Well, part of the what we expect the government to do is to characterize Billy as a fictional writer about what happened in 75, 76, 78, et cetera, et cetera. Colonel Caron's activity substantiates independently those activities that Billy asserts, the illegal activities that took place in Central South America and in the United States. So he is a very important witness to the background for the suit, and also the reason he will be able to show that our allegations that there was a cover-up, and a lot of the defendants are named as participating in this submersion of facts. Colonel Caron will be able to show that it happened before, up until the mid-80s, and it has certainly happened during Mr. Tyree's service with the Army.
Okay. Dee, back to you. Now, Colonel Caron, your father, was no stranger to Oliver North. What are you in a position to tell us about that?
I know he worked with Oliver North in South American region. He was paymaster for Oliver North's activities. He was pretty much the man who went and paid for all the illegal activities going on. He was brought in when there were problems, and he was brought in when people had to be paid to do what needed to be done.
Now, are we talking about in the 1980s?
We're talking up until about 1985, 1986.
Okay, but the activities vis-a-vis Oliver North are in that time period.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to mention here, and as I wrote in my report, Dee may want to clarify this, but the name George Bush came up, I think, also frequently in connection with the word Amadeus, and Dee might comment on that.
I was going to bring that up because there's a gentleman by the name of Jim Strauss that my father had gone to Mexico with. He was also part of the agency, and I was told that the head, or possibly ID, Amadeus was George Bush.
Okay, and that came from Colonel Caron, your father?
Yeah, and also from Jim Strauss.
Okay, all righty. Mike Rupert, tell us briefly what the Nugan Hand Bank was before we get back to Dee.
Nugan Hand Bank was an evolution of CIA drug operations to fund covert operations from Southeast Asia, which arose in Australia in the late 70s under the leadership of a former Green Beret named Michael Hand, and I forget the Mr. Nugan's first name.
Frank.
Wound up with the suicide of Nugan in, I think it was 1980. The Nugan Hand Bank had on its board of directors, well, its counsel was William Colby, but it had on its board of directors a host of military and CIA figures, and it was extremely well documented by Alfred McCoy and others, and especially in the Australian presses, being closely linked to CIA, the drug trade, money laundering, and a host of very illegal activities, up to and including the destabilization of the Australian government.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a legendary operation in that it was a very audacious and above-board thing. They took a lot of money from military and government people and basically defrauded a lot of people out of their money as well. When the scandal broke, it made a lot of news. It's been well documented, and I had a great interest in the Nugan Hand Bank already when I first went to meet Dee in 1994. And I was very surprised to find out that as I had I constructed a list of names trying to piece together Albert Caron's life, and I was there with my then-fiancé. And we made a list of names, and I forget how long it was. It was 15, 20 names, and we had some fictitious names in there. But I had started mentioning names to Dee and her husband, Tommy, and Dee picked out the whole board of directors of the Nugan Hand Bank, or close to the whole board of directors, including General Edwin Black, and there were several other names in there. And she picked out all of the names and said, my father knew all of those people.
Dee, what are you in a position to tell us, beyond what Mike Rupert mentioned, concerning your father and the Nugan Hand Bank?
The only thing I can tell you concerning that is that he was in Hong Kong quite often, okay?
Right.
Dad had stated that they did a lot of money laundering due to the drugs through Nugan Hand. You had some major military people that he worked with, General Leroy Manor, General Black. Some way, shape, or form, General Stilwell was involved in it, General Richard Stilwell. And my father and General Stilwell had gone back quite a bit. because my father at one time was with Stilwell in training for guerrilla warfare with General Stilwell. And they just used the bank. And what Mike was saying about how they really embezzled quite a bit of money from innocent people, especially out of California. They would get them to invest. These people would never see their money again. And little did they know that their money was going for covert operations.
Mm-hmm. That's a pattern that has sadly not been all of that unusual.
No, it happened again in Hawaii with a firm called BBRDW, but that's, they don't change their ways much.
Nope. Yeah, and Dan Sheehan actually was representing some of the people, Daniel Sheehan of the Christic Institute, in connection with that case. Can you tell us, what are you in a position to tell us about your father's passing and his illness?
When Dad came back from Mexico, my father wound up he did not come back the same man he left as.
Okay.
He was very depressed. He was very disillusioned. He made the remark that he was sick of the way operations went. He was just distraught over whatever had happened, okay? He stated the black suits would be there to get him. He was not long for this world. He had, at one point, when he was talking about this, he decided that he was going to start talking about his life and people that I needed to make sure that I remembered their names. And he stated that it just wasn't the way it should be. He wound up having a meeting with Michael Harari. He knew Michael Harari very well. And after this meeting, Dad wound up getting very sick. All tests that were done on my father came back chemical toxicity of unknown etiology. My father's left side of his brain atrophied within a 6-month period.
And this was in the mid-1980s, correct?
1986.
Go ahead.
That's when it started.
Okay.
After my father's meeting with Michael Harari one morning, that evening, Dad was rushed to the hospital. My husband, Tom, took him to the hospital. They thought it was either food poisoning or severe ulcers. They couldn't find anything. Like I said, within 6 months, my father's brain started atrophying on one side. His organs started shutting down. He wound up having to go on to kidney dialysis. And he wound up dying in 1990. But 1986, I guess Dad felt like he had to clear his conscience. I don't know. I remember, though, one statement, because my father knew he was dying, and he was buried at Santa Fe National Cemetery. And I remember stating to my father that he would be buried in his full dress uniform with all his medals. And my father looked at me and told me that I had one order from him and one last wish, and that was to burn his uniform and to throw away the medals, because it wasn't what it appeared to be.
Now, even though your father passed away in 1990, he is still being listed as active duty military by the armed forces.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary.
Well, wait a minute. You have to remember something.
Mm-hmm.
My father was buried as a staff sergeant.
Right.
Okay, his rank was full bird colonel. When I went to Santa Fe to state, this is wrong, and I started looking into things, because everything started disappearing. Bank accounts that I was on with my dad were gone. They said they never existed. And there is proof that they did. They wiped him out from the police department. They wiped out the bank accounts. I can't even get my father's birth certificate. They say he never existed. up until 3 years ago, they stated he never had a Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter what I had. They stated not so. The military turned around and said my father was never with the military.
Mm-hmm. So from an official standpoint, he became the man who wasn't there.
Exactly.
Right, and very briefly, because we've heard this story before and we're getting near the end of the interview, Theodore Shackley was instrumental in getting your father's headstone changed.
I had called Theodore Shackley because my father stated he knew Theodore Shackley and that he had worked with him.
And by the way, Theodore Shackley was one of the main players in CIA covert operations for many years for the benefit of listeners. Go ahead, Dee.
Okay. My father had stated he knew Theodore Shackley from the Golden Triangle, time of Vietnam. I called Theodore Shackley, to put it very bluntly. I turned around and told him, I don't care about your drug running. I don't care how you people eliminate anyone. But I do care that my father does not exist and that his headstone reads Staff Sergeant. He asked me what the hell I wanted with him. I told him I wanted my father's headstone changed, and I wanted my father's identity put back. Within 10 days of this phone call, I received an inter-office memo stating that my father's headstone was changed to full bird colonel. What I couldn't accomplish in like 5 years was accomplished in 10 days after a phone call, to which I am very grateful to this man for.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, he showed up on police department records. All of a sudden, he showed up on Social Security records. So his identity to this point has pretty much been put back. Military came back and stated 3 times he didn't exist with them, and then came back and stated, well, yeah, he did exist, but for 17 years and no further, and if I want to produce my records, they'll help me.
One of the activities that your father touched on were the activities that took place in Dallas, Texas, in and around November 22nd, 1963. What are you in a position to tell us about that, Dee?
I can tell you that he was instrumental with a woman by the name of Ruth Payne. He paid Ruth Payne to find Lee Harvey Oswald. He worked very closely with Frank Sturgis. He knew Jack Ruby through organized crime connections. He is the man who paid Jack Ruby to pay Frank Sturgis and others to take out JFK.
This, by the way, we should say allegedly made.
Allegedly.
Payments. Yes, again, simply for legal purposes. Now, obviously, Jack Ruby had a long history of involvement with organized crime.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth Payne was one of the people who helped to shepherd the Dallas, helped to shepherd the Oswalds around in the Dallas-Fort Worth area,
mm-hmm.
and was instrumental in getting Lee Harvey Oswald his job with the Texas School Book Depository. Frank Sturgis, or Frank Fiorini, is also a man whose name has cropped up in connection with the investigation.
Well, I will tell you, I did not know. My father was very good friends with Frank Fiorini.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know until 2 years ago that Frank Fiorini and Frank Sturgis were the same person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I know he was in Dallas. I will put it this way. He was in Dallas with Frank Fiorini.
Okay.
Okay.
And that was the name that Frank Sturgis was using at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so your father was allegedly in Dallas with Frank Fiorini.
Mm-hmm.
Your father left home on the evening.
Previous day.
He left on 11/21/63.
He came home late the night of the 22nd, about midnight. He came home in full dress uniform. He left in full dress uniform. Dad stated that the military was given orders to stand down.
That means basically that they were given orders not to do anything.
From what I understand, or from what Dad had explained, a stand down order, when the president travels, there's some type of military alert or whatever going on.
Mm-hmm.
The military was given orders to stand down.
Right.
When JFK was coming into Dallas.
Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, by the way, has made the same statement with regard to the military's behavior in Dallas. Go ahead, Dee.
They were told not to do anything.
Did your father have any comments to make about what went on that day, on the day of Kennedy's assassination?
Not to me. The only thing that Dad ever stated was that a lot of the agency's problem with JFK had to do with the Bay of Pigs, and that he wanted to eliminate, to a certain point, the agency. Because I guess the agency, the way Dad put it, he felt that the agency, JFK felt that the agency was out of control. And that a president should know what was going on and not be on a need-to-know basis by the agency. And that is pretty much why it was a coup, because that's what he referred to it as, a coup.
Your father actually referred to Kennedy's assassination as a coup.
Yes, he did.
Ray Coleman, there's been an affidavit submitted in connection with the lawsuit, I understand, in which Colonel Caron was actually on a building at Love Field with a rifle.
Yes, that was one of the statements that was given in the affidavit.
It was given by my husband, because my father had spoken to my husband.
Okay.
Okay.
Another of the names that crops up in connection with your father and the activities in Dallas is that of Marita Lorenz, Dee.
He knew Marita very well, and I have spoken to Marita. Marita tells me that she was in the motel room when my father had paid. Jack Ruby had come to pay them. My father was there. Marita did not know exactly what was going down at the time. And she had left with another gentleman, okay? She has also stated that Lee Harvey Oswald was in that motel room.
Right, right. And your father allegedly also knew Marita Lorenz.
Oh, yes.
And she confirms knowing your father.
Yes.
Okay. Mike Rupert, you mentioned that in a book there is a mention of an Albert Caroni in connection with Jack Ruby.
Yeah, I have to be very careful with this because I have a very confidential source who I don't want to jeopardize. But I will say that there is an established journalist who was writing a book, and he submitted portions of this book to a publisher. It has not been published. It has never been published.
We're almost out of time, Mike.
In 1992, in which he describes having met an Albert Caroni in a Northern California city in connection with a mob figure, and during that conversation, Albert Caroni was talking about Jack Ruby. Now, this event was described in a book, or chapters of an unpublished book, which I have now, long before I ever met this writer or before I ever met D.
Okay, which would tend to corroborate what we've heard so far. We are out of time. I want to thank all of you for participating in this interview. Ray Coleman, attorney for Bill Tyree and law partner of William Pepper. Mike Rupert, former LAPD narcotics detective and a crusader against the intelligence community's involvement in the narcotics traffic. And Dee Caron Ferdinand, the daughter of Colonel Albert Vincent Caron. I want to thank all three of you, in particular Dee, since you're new to our airways. Thanks so much for sharing your experience with us.
Thank you for letting me speak.
Okay, and thank you, gentlemen, as well. For Ray Coleman, Mike Rupert, and Dee Ferdinand, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.